It's a heartwarming tale, isn't it?
Here's where we should give credit to Joel Church Cooper for developing this show. He's terrific.
Joel Church Cooper is the head writer of this show. He wrote most of the episodes. He wrote that pilot. This was a short on Funny or Die that I wrote with some friends like 8 years ago. And I was really shooting that short, if you see it, is very, I think it's very funny, but it's very sophomoric and outrageous and kind of captures what I thought was the joke of this character. And over the years, Joel started writing appearances for this character and this and that, and he saw in it this kind of alcoholic, dark, sad, emotional undertone that I never even realized was there. He kind of took it literally, like, well, what if a guy really did this? His life would be pretty tragic. And really ran with it, and it wasn't until... You know, as a producer, once you get a green light for a thing like this, you get scripts and you go 900 miles an hour and you kind of check boxes like, is it smart? Is it funny? Does it make sense? Is the story good? And it was. And like, great. Then as we started shooting it and I was memorizing it and working on it as an actor, I started realizing this stuff is pretty emotional and kind of dark and kind of real and kind of moving. And that's all, yeah, to Joel's credit, including I rarely ad-libbed, rarely. Most of what you saw there was written 100% by Joel.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's any other major role of yours where this much pathos is in play. I don't know that Chief Wiggum is off doing this kind of stuff necessarily.
Well, he's never had the opportunity, John. I mean, that's not fair at all. Chief Wiggum would have been, like, really good in, what was that, Prince of the City. I would have been a great... If only I had the chance. Now I'm sad. I hope you're happy, John.
But is that something that you've
Serpico.
Had to do?
Serpico. I'd have been a good Serpico.
Have you had to tap into the demons that much in other roles? I mean, I feel like this would be way up there.
Yeah, that's another, again, you know, to me, my whole life, I've really been trying to make some version of this character that it turned into some kind of, you'll see, honestly, I love that pilot. I'm glad you guys seem to enjoy it. I'm glad you did. The show kind of builds as it goes along, and it's a very strong narrative, which I'm very happy about, too. And Jonah comes in episode 7 and steals the darn thing. And
it's not true at all.
But, yeah, you know, it's in many ways, it's my favorite thing I've ever done. Like, in Ray Donovan, I play a pretty edgy guy, and I've had roles where I've had dramatic roles, but this is definitely the most satisfying one.
And there's a lot of speaking in first person, which raises the extremely obvious question, how much Ricky Henderson footage did you study for this role?
Yeah, Brockmeyer certainly admired Ricky Henderson. Actually, I think Ricky got that from Brockmeyer, quite frankly. yeah, but... No, you'll see. That's the way Brockmeyer works out problems, is to kind of speak out loud to himself. It's like, Jim Brockmeyer was stuck. You know, and he just kind of goes in this crazy monologue at the bar trying to decide whether he should lean into his internet fame or not. And someone says, is he aware that he's speaking out loud? And Amanda goes, yeah, no, it's the way he processes things. It'll be over soon.
I love the Joe Buck clip. It's very short. And... just to
Is that
tell a
why
story.
You like it? Because it's short?
no, I misspoke. But we spent a day on set. It was myself, Brian Kenny, Tim Kirkchin, and Joe Buck, and it was so fun. And the part that was written for Joe was great, and we're not going to watch that episode here other than a short clip, but maybe you could walk people through the way that it manifests itself, because I think that Joe has a reputation. Not everybody likes Joe Buck. I did a podcast with him a few months ago. Right, I did a podcast with him a few months ago. He was actually super delightful, and he's a really interesting guy. But in this episode, it's just full-on hatred, and there's even, I don't want to give too much away, but there's the threat of violence with Joe Buck. It's pretty tremendous, the hatred that your character has for him.
Yeah, Jim Brockmeyer hates Joe Buck, and he hates Brent Musburger. for good goddamn reasons. And he's actually pretty jealous of Joe Buck. I'm not sure which clip we're going to see.
I think it's the one around the bar where it's his five
Oh, right.
Or six
this is where you'll see Jonah's acting triumph.
Tour de force, yes.
And as well as we have Tim Kirkchin and Brian Kenny and Joe, and they're all kind of They're kind of bonding the way sports writers, sports broadcasters, baseball men tend to do. But yeah, Brockmeyer hates Joe Buck, and they sort it out. I gotta tell you something. Joe Buck is incredibly game, and really, we wrote a lot for Joe Buck to do. Like, he's got a serious role in the thing. We were like, and we built in fail safes in case Joe Buck sucked so that we could sort of bypass the story and like, well, we could cut this scene right out if he's just horrible. And we were all like, we could not believe how good Joe Buck was. Seriously, if we hired, because another plan was if we couldn't get Joe Buck or really anybody, we would have just hired an actor to play a Joe Buck-like character. If we had done that, I promise you, nobody could have been as good as Joe actually was. I was a little stunned. I was shocked by how good Joe was.
He was.
You might, I guess, you know. Anyway, I'm not going to say. Anyway, go ahead.
So we're going to have a Mets panel afterwards, and we're going to talk a little bit of Mets. But
yay.
Yeah, it'll be a good time. But I want to ask you, in a lifetime of Mets fandom, if there's one story that comes to mind, if it's I remember where I was when Buckner happened, or this was the thing that resonates with the Cespedes trade, or one thing, because I mean a fandom is not necessarily a narrative, it's flashpoints, it's moments. So if there's one thing that stands out to you as, oh yeah, I witnessed this and this was a high point or a low point, or I can't believe I was in this situation when I found out about this.
No, you mentioned this backstage and I've been racking my brain to have one amazing if you will Met story. I had just moved to Los Angeles in 86. I was 22 years old when that ball rolled through Buckner's legs. I remember leading up to that, I remember saying to myself then, in 86, I remember saying to myself, well, the Red Sox have suffered a long time. I guess I'm happy for them. I mean, it was a long time before they got that opportunity again. And I was never more... In that moment, when that ball went through Buckner's legs and I wasn't here, I wasn't back in my beloved Queens celebrating, I kind of vowed I'm going to get back to New York someday, not in small part because I just enjoy being a Met fan in this town. And it took me many years. I didn't move back until 27 years after that. And I joke that I moved back to New York partially because I want to raise a Mets fan. My son is about to be 8. But it's not totally a joke. It really isn't, and this is neither totally a joke. I feel like it's such an intense thing to be a Met fan. It's been fun the last couple of years, but as I don't know how many Mets fans we have here, but as we all know, it's yes.
Seven line in the house.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Mets, Jets, Knicks is rough, which is, I'm from Queens, I have no choice. I was born into it, and I really do need support in my old age. I need to bring someone into the disturbing family business, family sideline. And the only other thing I'll say is, seriously, some of the greatest joys of my life as a father have been alone with my son at Citi Field. You know, there's a scene later in Brockmeyer where Brockmeyer is wondering if he should be a dad or not, and he actually has a catch with Tyrell, with Charles, the character who hates baseball and knows nothing about baseball. And it's what a father and son should do with each other. And my son, I don't know, I had got kids here, but you ever tried to explain the rules of baseball to a child? You realize how absurd a lot of it is, how very difficult a lot of it is, how esoteric a lot of it is. You know, I'm sitting there explaining baseball to my son, and he, at Citi Field, and just interesting semantic questions, like, Daddy, why is it called a walk if they always jog to first base? You can't possibly answer that question. This was his most intense question. He had taken a lot of it, and he's like, okay, what does spitting have to do with everything? Why are they spitting? And like even things like, what's the difference? I try to explain this to a 5-year-old. What's the difference between running home and a home run? It's hard to explain to a child. But really, some of my greatest joys are now making memories of Citi Field. Like, my dad brought me. So those are my Mets. That's my little Mets monologue.
Great. I will tell briefly my one Mets story. And by the way, I'm so sorry about the torture of being a Mets, Jets, and Knicks fan. I'm a Montreal Expos fan. That must be so hard for you. So hard.
At least your team doesn't exist anymore.
That's true. The pain is over.
Yeah, you were put out of your misery.
It's kind of true. So briefly, I'll tell my favorite Mets story. I used to go with my idiot buddies, and we'd sit in the right field bleachers at Olympic Stadium, which still exists, God knows why. And we would sit out there, and we'd heckle, and we'd do all those things. And the Mets killed us. Like, 86, 87, 88, when they were very good, they just destroyed the Expos, killed them. And Darryl Strawberry was the best player on the Mets. And Darryl Strawberry, on opening day of 1988, hit a ball that actually went over, like, above the roof at Olympic Stadium for a home run. It was off Randy St. Clair. You could actually see the terror in Randy St. Clair's eyes. He realizes, at best, I'm going to be a pitching coach later in my career because it's over now.
He realized it in that moment?
That moment. It, all his life flashed before his eyes. He's like, this is not going to happen. 85 in straight. It's not going to get done. And we grew so disenchanted and frustrated with Darryl Strawberry that one game in the right field bleachers, we're about 13 years old. We waited until the seventh or eighth inning because we were smart. We didn't want to get ejected too early. We took a crate of strawberries and started throwing them at Darryl Strawberry.
That's inspired.
Is it? We're kind of assholes, I think. I want to ask you, you've played a whole bunch of different characters, and I feel like the main ones sort of stand out. But sometimes the one-offs can be really fun, whether it's a guest star on one particular show, what have you. Sometimes you don't necessarily get a chance to expand and really evolve something into, okay, well, this is going to be a big one. I'm wondering if there's one character that you've done just once or twice. Oh, I really love that one. I wish something could have happened, whether it was a bigger role in that show, maybe you spun it off, something like that, where it was the proverbial Poochie, I guess, is the way that I would describe it.
Are you talking specifically about The Simpsons?
I'm not at all talking about The Simpsons. It can be anything you want. I mean, Agador Spartacus was a great character. Maybe he should have had his own movie. You know, I mean, whatever comes to mind.
Thank you for saying that about Agador Spartacus. Oh, my God, thank you. Oh, I loved you. You in particular. They wrote a sequel for Agador Spartacus.
Is that right?
And get this, please, Jonah Carey. In this movie, Agador Spartacus, I swear to God it's true, Agador Spartacus is a kicker in the NFL. Yeah, I agree. This was my reaction.
I'm not a wealthy man. I will take whatever savings I have and become an investor in this movie. Please make this movie. Please.
Just today, I was recording some Simpsons today, and I was recording some of what is Bill Hader's favorite character, which is this guy. Hey, Pally. He doesn't even have a name. He appears in the script as Wise Guy. And Bill Hader, who's got obviously a great ear, he was astoundingly to me, he was able to identify what iconic actor that voice is based on. He's a tough guy actor from yesteryear. Anybody? Yes, very nice. Very good. Charles Bronson. Very good. And I was just complaining today that, hey, there's never been a Wise Guy episode. Come on, guys. I was complaining to the writers that we should get one. They're like, man, we'll probably get there soon because we're having trouble thinking of new stuff. I guess some Wise Guy, I guess. I lobbied for Frank to have an episode. Professor Frank, of course. We're all familiar with Professor Frank. That was the only time I asked for, he was inspired by Jerry Lewis. For most of you folks here, there used to be like things called payphones and stuff, and then before that, there was Eddie Murphy movies, and even before that, his Nutty Professor, there was Jerry Lewis's Nutty Professor, and he sounded a very good deal like this. And since that was inspired by Jerry Lewis, I said, please have him play Frink's father in a Halloween episode, and they were kind enough to do it. So that's the only times I've ever, those two, I don't know. That's about it.
I want to give the audience a chance to ask questions, if that's possible. I don't know if, Kevin, can't see anything at all. I could also literally walk off the stage and probably hand somebody a mic if they're close enough.
We're here, Jonah.
Cool. Do I need to pass a mic?
No.
Okay, I can hear you. Go ahead. I don't know where you're talking from.
Hi. I'm right here. Anybody have a question?
We'll answer questions on anything, religion, science, potpourri.
Yeah, I had Hank on my podcast recently, by the way, and we recorded it on Election Day, And that was very trippy. And we didn't release it until 5 months later. It was like a time capsule with a friend. Remember those days, Hank? Before the results of the election, that was a lot of fun. So,
yeah. What did Bill Maher call it this week? Oh, the day the earth stood still.
Yes, yeah. That's right. Yeah. That was an interesting one.
Hey there. No, if you could see me, I'm right here. That was an awesome pilot, by the way. Kudos to you. And it sort of, I don't mean to draw comparisons, but it sort of reminds me a little bit of like a Better Call Saul-y sort of vibe to it. There's something there that just seems like, you know, anti-hero, and it seems like as the narrative progresses, it's going to become perhaps a bit, maybe even darker, and dive into sort of like the relationship with the wife, etc., a bit more. But do you see this becoming? I mean, clearly you're the star of that, but you've got great co-stars like Amanda Peet. Do you see it becoming perhaps even more sort of like an ensemble show where we learn more about their backstories as well? The other, you know, players in the pilot, because that would be fascinating as well. I mean, obviously you did great work, but I feel like with a
You're more interested in the other characters. That's fine.
No, I feel like
no problem.
All boats rise, right? Yeah.
Try to backpedal now and make it sound better. No, yes, absolutely. Partially because I can't possibly keep that up, yes, shows tend to then start to spread it out. Season 2 is already written, and it actually features Tyrell's character quite a lot, Charles quite a lot. We kind of really go deep there. So yes is the answer to your question. And season 2 is actually, I can't believe it, but he actually did a better job even than he did with season 1, which I didn't think was possible.
Back, here in the back on your left.
Hello.
Hello.
I understand Lindsay Nelson was part of the inspiration, obviously the jacket, but I'm curious to know, being that you were in New York back in the time, if Billy Martin ever entered your mind.
He did not. I'm a Mets guy, although growing up, I grew up in the 70s. Those Billy Martin, Reggie Jackson, Bronx Zoo, Yankees were too much fun not to pay attention to. I didn't choose. I thought it was fine to love both teams, and I did. I only started hating the Yankees in 2000 in the Subway Series when Clemens threw that bat at Piazza is when I started hating the Yankees. Billy Martin, you mean because it's so alcoholic and dark, and is that where you're going with it? No. I mean, there's plenty of that to draw on. But I didn't think of Billy Moore. What really more inspired the tone of this more is movies from the 70s that I loved, like Bad News Bears and Slapshot. We were shooting for that in the look of it. And, you know, in Bad News Bears, how that they're emotional and realistic and yet really funny about alcoholic people who try to redeem themselves through the getting back to the best part of themselves as exemplified by the pure love of their sport is sort of what we were going for. Also, that mixed in with, you guys see The Battered Bastards of Baseball? Have you guys seen this? Yeah. Amazing documentary about Kurt Russell's dad, Bing Russell, and what he did with the Portland Mavericks, this independent league team, and a lot of what happens with the Frackers, and was sort of inspired by that story. But not Billy Martin.
All right, thanks. We're just here in the front.
Hank, in addition to doing a great generic baseball guy voice, are there any like specific baseball announcers or figures that you like to do impressions of?
I do sort of hacky impressions of them. Harry Shearer is a genius. If you watch The Simpsons, every time you think you're hearing Vin Scully, that is actually Harry. In fact, in episode 6, I believe, of Brockmeyer, you get a flash. Each episode starts with a flashback, like the pilot does in Young Brockmeyer. Is a very troubled childhood, and he tries to escape into the from the nightmare reality of his abusive father into listening to the ball game. And you hear Vin Scully, and it's actually Harry. I do a sort of a bad Vin Scully, a sort of generic Vin Scully, as Harry is a and I do, you know, sort of a bastardized Keith Jackson, who, Nelly? And Harry does a genius Keith Jackson. I do Bob Murphy. Bob Murphy is kind of Brockmeyer if he hadn't
way too many cigarettes and beers. Bob Murphy. I used to love Bob Murphy. But no, I don't. This voice stuck with. I've done Brockmire many times on The Simpsons. When Harry's not, I'm often like Harry's, you know, play-by-play guy or color guy, and so kind of just generic baseball voice will show up in that kind of unsung. But no, that voice really is the one that I latched onto as a teenager.
So I had a question. They gave me a mic.
Awesome.
I really love the pilot. This is actually my second time seeing it, and it was cool to see it again. And so I wanted to ask you, because one of the reasons why I've been a big fan of yours for a very, very long time, and I was excited to see this because I could tell from your performance, I was like, oh, he is having so much fun in this role. And so it's fun for me to watch you have so much fun. So my question to you, because you've said this is your favorite character that you've played, I would love to hear more about why that is, like why you like it so much.
Part of it's love of baseball. It has been an idea I've had for so long in one way, shape, or form. I thought as a teenager, there's something with this voice that should be done. 20 years ago, I tried to develop using this voice, a telemarketer character used to call you at home and go, hi, do you have 5 minutes for me this afternoon? And spent about a year or two developing that and never went anywhere. Did this, 10 years ago, I walked into my agent's office and said, how do I restart some things? I have all these, I had about 7 or 8 characters, this being one of them that I had never gotten to use, voices that I thought were good. And I said, I'm not on SNL. I'm probably not going to be. I'm not on Mad TV. Probably not going to be. There aren't too many places to do this stuff. And, Will Ferrell and Adam McKay, they started Funny or Die about 10 years ago. And they're like, my agents were like, you go over there. If you have an idea that you like, they'll produce it and pay for it to be shot. And, if all goes well, who knows? Maybe you develop it into something later. And you always say that. It never happens. But that did. We developed it into a movie. We actually got financing for it. We're in pre-production for 5 weeks, the movie version of this, the independent film version of this. Lost financing 4 days before shooting, which happens. To the tune of about $600,000 went bye-bye, which Funny or Die was kind enough to like stay with it. They believed in it. So then we tried another year to get it made as a film. Couldn't. Then somebody had the idea, let's develop it into a cable series. I love the modern era of cable. Thought the more we developed it, the more I was like, I think this might lend itself even a little better to having the time to tell the story and this and that. But I'm telling you, there have been lawsuits and all kinds of difficulties and so many setbacks. I would love this thing if it were just something that was a good idea and we got made in a year, but it's been an incredible personal journey for me to do this thing. So that's partially also why I'm particularly excited about it and why I genuinely enjoy it. And I also feel like, late in my career, I'm about to be 53 this month. I swear to you, I just feel like it's in the last 5 years that I feel like I know what I'm doing and that I can really enjoy what I'm doing. And I'm glad that this is being done in that period of time, as opposed to even 10 years ago when I would have been much more uptight and nervous about it and probably having less fun. So there.
Talking about Vin Scully here, he's really the reason why I fell in love with baseball. And just I'm thinking about a first season without having my voice of my passion, my love. Like, who do you see in the next 20 to 30 years to really kind of be that personality to kind of, not necessarily over, be larger than a team, but kind of, can develop into a kind of lifelong passionate love with your team, a connection to a fan base? Because I don't even know what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm going to do without Vin Scully this year. It's just, it's literally, I don't know, I'm depressed. I don't know.
Yeah, you seem really down.
Yeah. It's... I don't know what to do. I can't deal with two color.
I feel a lot of pressure on the answer. If I don't answer, you're gonna really be upset.
I'm very upset.
I'm sure there's many folks out there who will take up the. I hate to say this, but don't you, Jonah, I don't think we'll ever see the like again of Vin Scully. I hate to say this, but I mean, to me, the closest modern equivalent vocally to Brockmeyer, I think, and this guy's in no way a hack, quite the contrary, is John Miller. I love John Miller, but I don't know that John Miller is quite the same, right, icon as Vin Scully. Vin Scully is a literal bridge to the past. Will he ever? I don't think so. I think Gary Cohn's amazing. I love Gary Cohn. You know? Vin Scully? I mean, come on. Vin Scully was, at one point, Brockmeyer gets promoted and gets a one-man booth. And he's like, I don't believe it. You know, Red Barber, Vin Scully, and now Jim Brockmeyer. And it's, we tend to forget he's so smooth and unbelievable that it's just him alone in there monologuing. I don't know. What do you think?
That's right. We actually did a pitch talk with when John Miller was on stage, too, and he told some great stories, and he's probably as close as it comes, but there is something about the chronology of it. I was reading an article, it was like Life magazine or something like that, and it's all about Vin Scully totally taking over the baseball world and how generations have grown up on Vin Scully, and Vin Scully is the iconic voice in baseball, and there'll never be another Vin Scully. That piece was written in 1964.
The year I was born.
Right. So Joe Davis, by the way, who's replacing Vin Scully, is really good and not going to be an icon necessarily, but Joe's very good and worth listening to. And listen, you cannot replace God, but he is excellent. I think we have time for one more question. There's going to be more panels and more questions and stuff like that, but for this segment, we're going to do one more.
Yeah, we just got over here on your left.
Oh, God, last question. And mine was such an easy one, too. Actually, we'll do two. Why not? What is Brock... Why not? Right? Last question. What does Brockmeyer want when he orders top shelf booze so we can play along at home? What's your favorite show on television?
Brockmeyer's referring. His favorite is Sazerac Rye. That's his drug of choice.
Big Sazerac fan over there.
You got an Ed McMahon reaction to that. Yes, exactly. Oh, you are right. Alcoholic breath. I would do shots of Sazerac if you want. You can play at home. And what was part two? I'm sorry, I forgot. Oh, I do love cable right now. My favorite show of the last bunch of years has definitely been. This is not like an exotic pick. Breaking Bad. Might be my favorite show of all time, maybe. I've been recently watching, anybody else, Vikings, anyone? Yeah. Vikings? Really enjoyed that show. I like Floki. You know Floki? That's a very obscure reference. Viking fans out there. What else have I really loved lately? Oh, I just, to me... You know, I don't watch too much half hour. I much prefer hour because I really like narrative and good stories. To me, really the funniest show of the last decade has been It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Show just really makes me laugh. I admire a lot of other comedies like BoJack or Rick and Morty, but they don't make me laugh out loud as much as It's Always Sunny does. And, of course, Jim Brockmeyer. Come on, it's hilarious. Come on.
Well done. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back for more panels. Thanks for coming along.